Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku. Case 26 is entitled, Hyakujo Sits on the Great Sublime Peak. Main subject, a monk asked Hyakujo, what is the most wonderful thing? A monk asked Hyakujo, what is the most wonderful thing? Hyakujo said, I sit alone on this great sublime peak. The monk made a vow. Joe struck him. Sutro's verse. Across the ancestors' field went galloping the heavenly horse, Basso's successor. Different, however, in his way of teaching, in holding fast and letting go. His actions were quick as lightning, always fitting. A monk came to tweak the tiger's whiskers, but his efforts made him a laughingstock. So, this is the first day of our sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for doing such an excellent job and for coming. It's probably clear, or it's usually clear to people by, say, the end of day one, that we probably couldn't do this by ourselves. You know, if you were to try to sit this much in a day, it's probably the case that you wouldn't be able to do it. Now this having the structure of a sesshin and the amazing collective energy of people practicing together makes it possible to do a sort of superhuman amount of sitting. It's a little bit like people who try to educate themselves. If you try to read a lot of, say, British literature on your own, unless you have a burning desire, very difficult to read what you would read in, say, a typical British novel class, where you might have so many novels to read that you barely can keep up. Or if you take an American poetry class, you cover much more than you would probably be able to read on your own, and there's a structure that helps you to apply yourself. And sesshin is just like that. There's a structure here that makes it possible by around day two or day three to be in a very different mental space and really drop body and mind. And that is so liberating. Anybody who's done sesshin in the past, as everybody here has, knows what that feels like. And it's really made possible by this amazing structure, this sesshin structure. And we are in a classic sesshin. So in China, if you went to China more than 1,000 years ago, and you went to a Buddhist temple, most Buddhist temples would have been basically Zen temple at one time. And if you had gone to sesshin, you would see people doing exactly what we're doing on pretty much the same schedule. This is amazing that, we're doing this. And those people must have been building on earlier Indian models of practice. But this practice of sesshin has come down over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years to us. And it's a beautiful system for creating awakened mind, for lifting people out of their small selves and allowing them to enter or discover in themselves their Buddha nature. So really amazing. And it all depends on the power of sitting together, this collaborative effort. This morning, you know, you might have pushed yourself a little harder than you could have on your own. You know, by the end of the first sit, you might have been, your legs might have been hurting. By the end of the second sit, you know, if you were on your own, you might have gotten up and gone and had breakfast. But instead, we all stay here and sit. So this collective energy is really pretty amazing. It's obvious to anybody who practices Zen. It's the reason that there are Zen monasteries, you know, because people can do this better if they cooperate with each other, collaborate. That collective energy is astonishing. So all the more odd, then, is this koan. A monk goes to mass to see Hyakujo and says, "What is the most wonderful thing?" And Joe says, "I sit alone on this great sublime peak." What a strange thing to say, given what I just said. And this doesn't take place on a great sublime peak. This takes place in a monastery. So what is Hyakujo talking about? Baijang, what is he talking about? So that's the koan, basically. Right? What is he talking about? He's in a monastery. That monastery maybe has 100 monks or something like that. And the monk comes in and says, "Tell me, you know, what is the most wonderful thing?" And he says, "I sit alone on this great sublime peak." So Sesshin is really wonderful, wonderful opportunity. Partly because there's special sort of strictures, special sort of rules of Sesshin. You know, we don't talk. We're really not supposed to make a lot of eye contact. It's okay to do that, you know, but you're really supposed to be giving people space, right? And we're spending long hours each day on the cushion, you know, many hours, eight hours or 9 hours on the cushion. This is really for some people difficult to take. I mean, everybody here has been to Sesshin before, but some people find this really hard. You know, it's not necessarily the sitting that they find so hard, it's the solitude that they find so hard. Because even though we're together, we're also sort of alone in a certain sense. I mean, when you enter a room ordinarily, people look at you, right? At least that's usually the case. Unless they're giving you a cold shoulder. So when you enter a room, people look at you, and even before a word is said, there's a dialogue, right? There's a dialogue of identities, right? This certainly happens to me. If somebody comes into my room at work, my office at work, you know, it would be very rude of me not to look up, yeah? What is it? You know, and I'm just working on my word processor. You know, it's important to pay people respect. You know, you stop typing on your word processor. You know, you turn to them, you look them in the eye, and you're saying, "I see you. I acknowledge you." You know, and the other person normally is glad to be acknowledged, right? I mean, usually that's sort of like a tacit, unspoken affirmation. I see you. You're worthy of my attention and time. And the other person usually responds in kind. You know, when you look at somebody, you can look at them with dead eyes, or you can look at them with lively eyes, right? When you look at somebody with lively eyes, the eyes are sort of bright, and you're saying, you know, "I'm so happy to see you. I'm so glad you're here. I value you so much." And usually the other person's face lights up. So this is like a dialogue of identity, right? You know, we're both acknowledging you exist, I exist, right? And often this is wonderful, wonderful. You know, we've been having some Tuesday night sits in Plainfield at a place called the Ducray School of the Arts, which is this school. It used to be a boys' school, and the people who are overseeing it are trying to turn it into a school of the arts. I don't know if it's going to succeed, but they invited me to teach meditation there on Tuesday nights. I was on my way, but there was a traffic accident. Somebody had actually driven at an intersection to avoid another car. They'd driven into somebody's front yard, crashed through the fence around their yard, and luckily didn't hit the house. But it was quite an accident. So as I came down my main street, the police were directing me in another direction. And when I went in that other direction, I got hopelessly lost trying to find this place. And so I don't carry a cell phone. You know, if I were living in the 21st century, I could use my phone. But I don't have one. So I drove around looking, and you know, it's getting closer and closer to 7 o'clock. So I drove back, I went through the intersection again, and there was a big gruff policeman, and another big gruff policeman, and then there was this smaller Hispanic policewoman, and the big gruff guy just waved me through, like, "Go on, go on," you know. But I stopped my car in front of the smaller Hispanic woman, and I said, "Listen, I'm looking for the Ducray School of the Arts. Could you help me out? Do you know where it is?" And she looked at me like a human being, and she smiled, and she said, "It's over there." So I was on the complete wrong side of the road, you know. So I found it, I got there, and everything worked out. But it was so wonderful. I've been in those situations before where, you know, suddenly somebody pauses and they look at you, and it's ratifying your existence. It's saying you're worthy of my time. I want to help you. And I was so lost that I was very grateful for her help. So that's a kind of dialogue, right, of identity. You look at me, I look at you, we acknowledge each other's existence. Normally this is okay, this is good, actually. It's a basic foundation of social interactions. But, you know, it actually gets more complicated than that, right? I mean, those are very simple human interactions. You know, a lot of the time, they're not so simple, and they're not so straightforward. So sometimes your relationships with other people are very complicated. And, you know, people can withhold recognition as a way of showing their displeasure with you, or they can withhold recognition as a way of punishing you, right? So actually, my father was very much like that. When he wanted to show you his displeasure, it was like you didn't exist. He would look through you. And, as a child, I would find that very upsetting. You know, it's like, I wasn't worthy of being seen by him, yeah? And there were times in my life where that was very, maybe want to make him notice me, you know? So at one time, I got in a lot of trouble when I was a teenager. I started smoking cigarettes and things like that. That definitely got my parents' attention in a bad way. And I remember my parents thinking, I'm sure they thought, why is he misbehaving like this? But I definitely think part of it was I wanted my parents to see me, and I didn't feel seen. So one way to get seen is to commit, like, minor crimes, right? So, complicated, right? You know, if you're not seeing me, I need to be seen. I definitely think that, later, one of the reasons I, worked so hard in school was that people would reward me for being smart, So I studied a lot, and I always tried to get good grades, and my teachers would, when they would look at me, they'd look at me like with a bright face. And, I don't know that I was so interested in the knowledge. I was really interested in being noticed and being acknowledged by my teachers with a bright face. And so, these relationships are complicated. When we look at other people, it's complicated, right? Because we're looking for, sometimes we're looking for something from them. Will you give me a look? Will you look at me? Will you acknowledge me? Your eyes become bright when you see me? And if people withhold that, it has an effect, right? It can make you more, uneasy. It can make you hungry for recognition. It can make you loathe yourself. You might think, what's wrong with me? Why won't he look at me? What is it about me? So it's complicated, right? We want to be a self that others see, but this puts us in a complicated relationship, and not always a good one, right? Not always a good one. When I was a very, this is before many people's time, but when I was young, the Beatles were quite famous. And the Beatles, interestingly enough, in their early phase of their career, all wore the same clothes. So the Beatles wore special Beatles clothes that had, they wore shirts and collarless jackets, and pants that stopped around their ankles, and they wore boots with pointy toes, and their hair was cut like somebody took a pair of scissors and cut along their eyebrow ridge, so that their hair, they had bangs like over their forehead, and their hair was cut the same. Each person had the same haircut. And they all wore these costumes. And when I was in school, it was like all of a sudden kids started getting on the bus, right, with these bowl haircuts, right, these bangs. And a lot of them had, you could go to the store and you could get pointy boots like the Beatles wore, and pants started getting tighter and tighter, and the pants would stop at your ankle, right? So all of these people are trying to be noticed because they see the Beatles are being noticed. It's like, nobody consciously thinks this, but it's like, if I can just be if I can dress like John, Paul, George, and Ringo, I will be like, I'll be admired like that. People will see me, girls will see me on the bus and they'll start shrieking. Of course, it doesn't work. But that was the idea, right? That was the idea. And it seems like a crude dynamic, but basically it couldn't keep those boots in stock, right? You'd go to the store, you'd beg your mother, "Would you buy me a pair of Beatles boots?" "No, come on, please, please, I've got to have the boots." "No." Finally, all right, buy me the boots. And then you go to school and nothing happens. It's like, I thought everybody was supposed to think I was cool. So these are relatively innocent examples, but it's wonderful to enjoy other people's company, but enjoying other people's company in a certain way is good, and in a certain way not so good for the people involved, because there's definitely you could say like power relations in people's interactions. And people bring to their interactions with others a desire to be seen in the proper way. And people work all their lives to be seen by others in the proper way, to have that person turn and with, a light in his eyes or a light in her eyes, saying, "Oh, I'm so glad you're here. You're such a worthy person." And so, it's a force for good. But it's also, we can get, if I may say so, we can get really screwed up, right? We can become very far from real to ourselves by pursuing the respect of other people, even though that sounds like an odd thing to say, or the love of other people, or the admiration of other people. You know, we can become very confused about who we are or what we want to do with our lives. You know, and we can be always on edge, on a sort of like off balance. It's like off balance. You know, I was reading this feminist writer, and she was talking about how she's a little younger than I am. But she said when she was in high school, you know, she would spend an hour a day getting ready for high school, and not studying. Getting her hair ready, her clothes, her makeup, her nails, and you know, spent a very large amount of time being physically what other people expected her to be. And she was saying that part of her inner process of liberation was freeing herself from that dynamic. You know. So, no longer going through the ritual of making herself acceptable. And, you know, I have read this also of people who, I remember reading a woman who was raised in a Muslim country and decided to take off her veil. And she said it was so difficult to walk around without a veil. And she said, I felt so judged all the time. So exposed to judgment all the time. When she was behind her veil, there was no judgment. You know, but suddenly she felt like it was all out there and that people were disapproving of her. So, you know, when we at Sesshin have this little procedure, this little practice of sort of not making eye contact, not making, looking people in the eye, it might be seem alienating, but it's actually quite an important teaching. You know, there was a guy who used to be a member of our group who would always leave Sesshin around day 2.5. You know, it'd be like day 2.5, and he would come in and see me with a terrified look. This went on for several years, and you know. And finally, he would come to see me and say, I want to come to Sesshin. And I'd say, no, forget it. You know, we've been through this again and again. He goes, no, it's going to be different this time. Right? So he'd come to Sesshin. It'd be like day 2.5, day evening of Dokusan, you know, Dokusan in the evening, day 3 or day 2 in the evening. He'd be in there, and I'd look, and his face was like a mask of terror, right? And he would flee. He'd say, I'm going. He'd say, oh. Somebody'd come in and I'd see the face. It was just like, okay, goodbye. You know? Eventually, he overcame that, you know. But one of the things I asked him was, what is it that, you know, it was the solitude, right? It was the solitude, you know, that feeling that nobody, you know, I'm alone, right? Alone. And I definitely understand that, you know. I don't want to make this a self-psychoanalysis session, but, you know, my father was one of these people who has to be, as they say, he had to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. You know? He had to be the center of attention all the time. And I remember once we went hiking with a group of people up in the Appalachian Mountains, and I got very sick, and I couldn't go on, and we had to stay in one of the lean-to shelters up in the mountains. And it was just me, and I was in my sleeping bag. I had a very high fever, and my father. But I remember, you know, as I got older, I remembered, you know, my father, he just was jumping out of his skin. You know, he didn't know what to do when he was by himself. You know, it was like he needed an audience to be real to himself. And you know, I think my father was a kind of person who just, he craved the acknowledgement of others, and not always in a good way. You know, my father was a military officer, and I remember when his boss came down to the military base. We were stationed in a Naval Weapons Station in Southern Virginia. And this big shot from the, you know, from basically the Department of the Navy was coming. And when this, I drove out to the airport. Our base had a little airport, and we drove out to the airport. And when this admiral got off the plane, I had never seen my father so anxious, fearful, and you know, obsequious. You know, he was. He absolutely brown-nosed this guy to and I was just a kid, and it was like, holy crap, you know, get, you know, have some self-respect. It was pretty amazing. Even as a little kid, I could see it, you know. My father really made himself, like, abjectly subordinate to this guy. And I later learned that this man had a lot of power over my father in his advancement in the Navy. And so it was crucially important for my father to impress this guy. But it was a little depressing for me as a child to see my father abase himself, you know, so much in the presence of this powerful man. But you know, this goes on all the time. It's part of our interactions sometimes. So it's important for people to practice together in a sesshin. We could never do this, probably, you know, on our own. And there's a collective energy and a dynamism that comes from practicing together that's like nothing else. I've had friends for 40 years who I practiced Zen with starting in 1977, right? And I still call them on the phone, you know. And those are deep, you know. I felt sometimes with my Zen friends a kind of intimacy that I didn't even feel with my own family. You know, sitting together in the heart mind is an amazing experience. And if you haven't done it, it's very difficult to communicate to other people. But I definitely feel closer to my Zen friends. I love my family, but I definitely feel that with my Zen friends, I have something that I just don't have with my sister, let's say, or my nephews. You know, so there's something special about this collaborative, collective practice. But there's also something complicated about our relationships with other people. We're often driven by this craving for recognition, and like my father, we sometimes, without even knowing it, you know, we twist ourselves into what we think the other person wants, and we do this on a very deep level, you know, very deep level. You'd be amazed at how many people. I work as an English professor. And I have had many graduate students over the years whose fathers or mothers were famous professors, and who go through graduate school, and at the end they suddenly realize, I'm not interested in this at all. But they thought they were, but what they were really looking for was mom's approval or dad's approval for those bright eyes, right? And they were going through this process of becoming worthy of respect and attention, but at the expense of ever understanding themselves, right? And you know, it wasn't like they were pretending. It wasn't like they were pretending in order to please dad. You know, we internalize these lessons or these structures or these values, and we keep reliving them. You know, last night I was talking about how samsara, I think, is such a deep insight on the Buddha's part to call hell, basically, you know, samsara. You know, where we keep repeating the same behaviors even though they make us unhappy. And if you say why, it's because, I think it's often because we're confused about our true nature. And we don't really, you know, we don't dare change because we don't know who we really are, you know. So you know, this encounter between between Yakujo, Bai Jang, and this monk is really quite important. They're sitting in a monastery, and the monk says, you know, what's the most wonderful thing? And Yakujo says, you know, how does he put it? He says, I sit alone on the great sublime peak. Now, you know, I think this is the voice of somebody who is deeply awake, who has liberated himself from this dynamic of seeking the approval of others in order to be real to himself. And you could substitute seeking the love of others, the respect of others, the subordination of others, whatever. You know, I think this is a voice of a deeply awakened person. You know, there's a Zen story about how when Bodhidharma was living in a cave for 9 years, waiting for students to show up, a student did show up, and it was in the middle of winter, and the student sat outside of Bodhidharma's cave, and Bodhidharma wouldn't really allow him to come in. And the man who was sitting outside the cave, according to legend, somehow had a big sword with him. It doesn't make any sense, but he had a sword with him, and he cut his arm off to show Bodhidharma how serious he was about practicing. And then Bodhidharma says, you didn't have to cut your arm off. I just made you stay out there for a while to see if you were a person who did... I wanted to make sure you didn't look to others for approval. See, not looking to others for approval. It could be not looking to others for recognition, self-worth, love, whatever. Now, such people are very rare because, you know, it takes a lot of sitting and a lot of cutting through obstacles to truly be free from this. Mostly we just repeat, right? We mostly just repeat over and over again the behaviors we've developed. And we don't step out. It's very difficult to step out without a structure like Sesshin or like some terrible crisis, right? A terrible accident or cancer diagnosis. Then people suddenly begin to sort of see the artificiality of their own identity. So, you know, when we sit in Sesshin, we're definitely practicing together. And we owe each other a great deal because we provide each other with this collective energy. We're all working hard. When one person doesn't move, it's easier for another not to move, and so on. But, you know, finally we have to drop this self that we've created in our interactions with others in order to be liked by them. And we have to have like an obscured relationship with the world, right? It's so interesting. You know, I was reading something, and I don't really know if it's true, but it makes a lot of sense. You know, when my grandmother died, She asked all the members of her family, she said, thank you so much for coming. You know, it's time for you to go. I need to rest. And then everybody left and she died. And, you know, something very similar happened to my mother. You know, when she was, we were all there and then we left, we went home, and we got the call, you know, your mother has died. And my sister is an oncology nurse, practitioner. And she said, this happens quite often. You know, some people want to be, they want their family around them, but then at the end, they want to be alone. And you think, alone with what? Alone, that seems so scary, but they're not alone alone. They're alone with something. What are they alone with? Well, it's possible that they're alone with the great sublime peak. Now, inside every one of us, there is this Buddha nature, we say, this enlightened mind. And, you know, often people live their whole lives and never have a face-to-face encounter with this. Maybe my grandmother had some inkling of this. You know, maybe my mother had some inkling, I don't know. But just the desire to be separate at that moment is such a mystery, right? It's like, why would people at the end of their lives want to be alone? You would think that's the moment you'd most want to have other people holding onto your hand and so on, but it's quite common for people, I want to face the sublime peak now. It's time. I've been your son, your husband, your daughter, your mother, your grandmother, whatever, all this time. And I faithfully played all my roles. But now I have to return to who I really am. See? And this is really what Zen is all about, right? We all have our roles to discharge. You know, we've been son, daughter, husband, wife, grandfather, grandmother, whatever. We've been teacher, doctor, whatever, right? Engineer, businessman, whatever. We've faithfully played our roles. Everybody's given us the smiling eyes. But now it's time to face the great peak, the great sublime peak, face to face, with no other considerations. This is awakened mind, right? You know, all the masks drop away and now we're going to have a confrontation, you could say, with Buddha nature, with who we really are, what we really are. So sitting on the cushion is done together, but we're sort of alone together, or we're together in order to have this encounter. And this is day one, you know, so it's a little difficult to begin to have that experience on day one, because we're still looking to others for approval. And you can say, what others? Well, all the others, right? All the others. But, probably it's the case. You know, it is important to have love in your life. It's important to be loved, and it's important to give love. There's no question about that. You know, it's important to be useful, you know, to have a job where you go in and you feel like you're making a contribution. You know, that's wonderful. Those are important things, so I'm not putting them down. But, you know, it's often the case that we're trapped in identities that make us unhappy and limit us. And this is our opportunity to break free from those identities and experience something much vaster, the great sublime peak. You know, in Buddhist literature and in Indian literature in general, you know, the universe was understood to be a mountain. It's kind of interesting, right? The Sumeru. The universe is a mountain. You know, so becoming one with the mountain means becoming one with the universe, in its vastness, the vastness that underlies us all. So the great sublime peak here is the great sublime peak of Sumeru. But we can only experience it one by one in deep Mushin. Nobody can go there for us. We have to go by ourselves and face the and become one with the great sublime peak. So that's why we're here. That's why we've come to Sesshin today. Everybody's doing a wonderful job. It's a great. Some of us have been sitting together for a long time. It's really wonderful. Main subject. A monk asked Baijiang, Yakuji, Japanese people call him Yakuji, what is the most wonderful thing? Jiang said, I sit alone on the great sublime peak. The monk made a bow. Joe struck him. So, you know, why did the monk bow? Why did Joe strike him? Well, maybe, we don't know. You have to sit with the koan, but maybe the monk was looking for Yakujo's bright eyes, still looking for approval, and hadn't found the sublime peak in himself yet. So Joe struck him, maybe. Setra's verse. Across the ancestors' field went galloping the heavenly horse, Baso's successor. So sometimes in Zen literature, a galloping horse is a symbol of freedom, real freedom, not looking to others for approval. Baso is in Japanese, he's called Baso. In Chinese, he's Matsu. Matsu. Matsu is horse ancestor. This is what his name means. So it's this kind of a joke here. Across the patriarch's field went galloping the heavenly horse, Baso's, Matsu's ancestral horse's successor. Different, however, in his way of teaching, in holding fast and letting go. See, nobody can discover the sublime peak for you. And how you experience it is going to be yours alone. See, it's your... It's just like that person on her deathbed saying, I need to be alone now. I've got to face this. At the last moment, it's me and the universe, right? His actions were quick as lightning, always fitting. The monk came to tweak the tiger's whiskers, but his efforts made him a laughingstock. In other words, the monk did a pretty good job, basically.